The Word of Mouth podcast from NHPR is made possible with support from you, our subscribers.
And by Heinemann, a provider of resources written by real teachers for real classrooms. Heinemann values teachers as decision makers and students as curious learners. Discover the path to lifelong professional learning at Heinemann.com. Heinemann, dedicated to teachers.
And by
Dartmouth Hitchcock, offering care in 30 locations across northern New England and in your community. Dartmouth Hitchcock is here. Dartmouth-Hitchcock.org.
This is Word of Mouth. Your questions answered, your state explored. I'm Taylor Quimby. Virginia Prescott is out this week. So instead of the usual hijinks, today we're going to be listening back to some of the questions that you, our audience, have asked us to investigate. And then we're going to hear some updates on what happened after those stories went into the world. Joining me in the studio are producers Hannah McCarthy. Hi, Hannah.
Hey there, Taylor.
And Jimmy Gutierrez.
What's up, TQ?
So we're going to start with a controversy that we stirred up very recently after we investigated a question about New Hampshire's signature foods. Specifically, the question was, what are New Hampshire's signature dishes? I heard it was boiled dinner, which sounds sad. And this one had us going because I don't think I've ever had boiled dinner. You guys?
I think I have. If corned beef and cabbage is a form of boiled dinner, then I've had boiled dinner.
It pretty much is. That's most of it. Jimmy?
And I grew up in the Midwest, and I've had a lot of bad food in my life, but I've never had boiled dinner.
Yeah. Well, anyway, Virginia, for this story, she started off by talking about New Hampshire's food history with Eric Waholtz. He's a historian at the Strawberry Bank Museum in Portsmouth. And they talked about a bunch of different things. They talked about, the sort of Native American traditions mixing with European colonial food traditions. But eventually they did get to the topic of boiled dinner.
If you don't know what we're talking about, boiled dinner usually appears on New England menus in the form of a corned beef brisket or ham, hemmed in by a variety of root vegetables and a couple of thick slices of what becomes limp cabbage. In fact, all of it pretty much turns to mush. It is, as its name would suggest, boiled, a sort of practical meal that looks as if it should be capitalized, like a proper noun, boiled dinner. Its history, though, is a little less austere. Was it considered a peasant food?
It was. They were boiling mostly European crops, cabbage and cauliflower, leafy coleworts, the brassicas. They often called it a gentleman's dinner if enhanced with meat stocks.
We looked online, and it is true that you will find the occasional article listing boiled dinner as New Hampshire's signature dish, although other states may make the same claim. Regardless, it is a meal that, especially during foliage season, you're going to find served at local bed and breakfasts and village restaurants. For now, anyway.
We're trying to rebrand the Fox Tavern, so it might be the oldest inn in New Hampshire, but I don't think the food should reflect that in the same manner.
This is Benjamin Harwood, the newly minted executive chef at the Fox Tavern, the restaurant at the historic Hancock Inn in Hancock, New Hampshire. Have you ever put boiled dinner on the menu?
Personally, I like boiled dinner once in a while, you know, St. Paddy's Day or what have you. Sure, it's definitely a New England tradition, but how long ago was that a tradition?
That's Benjamin's way of saying, yes, we sometimes have it on the menu, but maybe we shouldn't. How would you make boiled dinner taste really good?
I'm not sure. lots of salt and butter when it comes out, you know.
MSG.
Yeah, you can't go wrong with that.
That voice, suggesting we put a little MSG in the boil, is producer Taylor Quimby getting in on this conversation because he has a swooping theory about why boiled dinner truly may be the perfect Granite State dish.
It seems to me that this says something about New Hampshire's character that, you know, when you talk about signature foods from a lot of places, it's supposed to be like the food that is best in those places, like they do the best version of it. But our signature food, in the case of boiled dinner, is not even a signature food. It's like a signature way of erasing flavor from whatever you're cooking.
You pretty much nailed it. I really didn't want to go there. But since you touched on it, it's unfortunately, I don't think New Hampshire really has like a set cuisine. I think it's more encompassed throughout New England. With that being said, you could go to Boston, you could live in Boston and not eat at the same restaurant twice in the same year. And then with Portland, Maine, they're doing the same kind of stuff up there. It's just gorgeous, different things. And we're smack dab in the middle, and I think we're just kind of a little bit behind this food trend.
You know, in some ways, maybe people come to New Hampshire not wanting to eat boiled dinner because it tastes good, but maybe expecting that it's there.
I think that's kind of the wrong thinking of it, though. Doesn't that sound awful? Like, hey, let's pay money for something we're not going to enjoy just to say we had it. I don't know. It just seems counterintuitive.
Benjamin may be tilting at a one-pot windmill here, trying to balance tradition and expectations with the hipper food trends that he admires on the coast. But for now, he's willing to do whatever he can to convince folks to just try something new.
You know, and if you have someone that's like, if you don't have boiled dinner on your menu, you can go screw, give me their phone number. I want to speak to this person.
So that was the story. We all remember how it went.
Sad.
Yes.
Very sad.
Well, after this story aired, we did see some very heated debate when we posted it online. I had joked while we were making this piece that we didn't technically need, from a journalistic standpoint, a defense of boiled dinner.
And you were way wrong.
Oh, yeah, yeah. So we discovered that there's a lot of New England boiled dinner defenders out there. I got one of the most vocal online ones
Ooh.
That we found, and he gave me a written statement. I guess it's not written because he spoke it out loud, but he wrote it first.
Hello, NHPR. A few words, if I may, on your Only in New Hampshire segment about the relative merits or lack thereof of the humble New England boiled dinner. I feel that the otherwise good folks at NHPR have cast that apotheosis of Yankee thrift, the august and delicious New England boiled dinner, in a disrespectful light, and I am here to warn them that they do so at their peril. To those of us who grew up with New England boiled dinner as part of the rich tapestry of our formative years here in the Granite State, such cavalier treatment of a beloved staple of the region is the opening salvo in what promises to be a long, drawn-out culinary war. Now, while some may advocate for mercy by claiming that the poor people at NHPR weren't raised right and don't know any better, I suggest a more draconian approach. We should circle the NHPR building and make these whippersnappers walk a gauntlet of hurled cabbage and brisket until they come to their senses. Or perhaps we should just place a giant pot of New England boiled dinner on a hot plate in the lobby and let the aroma of our collective flintiness bring these poor souls from their wrongness where they currently languish to that place of stern, uncompromising Granite State flavor which the New England boiled dinner represents so well. I remain yours in frugal Yankee deliciousness, Michael J. Curtis, Allenstown, New Hampshire.
I will say I love free food, so if somebody brought a pot of boiled dinner to the station, I would eat it.
Yeah.
Gladly.
Wait, yeah. You both would?
Of course I would. I'm with Taylor. It's free food.
Yeah.
I've eaten a lot of things that I don't like all that much because it was free.
Have you eaten free disgusting vegetables or do you pass?
Disgusting? What do you mean by disgusting?
Like overcooked or like limp and soggy vegetables. Like
I think I have.
Like when you got school lunch and there was like the one tray that had like really nasty vegetables. Did you eat those or did you not eat those?
I would not eat those.
Okay. Because I would not eat those.
I would prefer the option of free food to being pelted with limp cabbage outside. Like what he was describing reminded me of that scene with Game of Thrones. Where Cersei
me too,
is
with
like
shame.
Yeah, yeah, that's not what I want. I don't want to be pelted with food as I walk into my job.
Yeah.
Okay, so on to our next story. This is one that I actually reported. Anyway, it has to do with a famous face that we're all used to seeing. When Henry Jackson moved to New Hampshire 4 years ago, he couldn't help but notice a certain rocky profile on his driver's license, on road signs, even on his marriage certificate.
Friends come visit me up here, and they're like, what's that like weird rocky thing on the highway signs? And then you have to explain that it's, you know, nothing anymore.
That's what prompted him to ask the question, why is state branding still focused on the old man of the mountain?
I'm wondering what the state's plan is for you know, either keeping that image going or moving on to something that's more relevant today?
That's actually a question that people have been asking since the day the old man fell in May of 2003. NHPR's news director at the time was Mark Beavis, and he spoke with then-Governor Craig Benson.
It is perhaps the most pervasive state symbol or symbol of any group or nation in the world.
So you don't see taking it off, say, advertising brochures or off the license plates or off our road tokens?
No, it won't come off of anything.
In truth, the state's branding has moved on. In 2012, the New Hampshire Division of Travel and Tourism Development launched a new ad campaign and website aimed at modernizing New Hampshire's outward brand for potential visitors. If you go to the page visitnh.gov, you're greeted with upbeat music and a video of people hiking in the whites, ziplining, playing in the waves on New Hampshire's coast. What you won't find is a single image of the old man of the mountain. Now, roadsides and license plates? That's another matter.
It was used as a symbol going back to the 19th century.
This is Michael York, New Hampshire State Librarian.
So you would have a road sign with the outline of the old man and then a route number.
But that kind of infrastructure isn't really part of the state's branding, per se. It's more like a form of ID. And like the state's old man license plates, it would cost a lot of money to change them all. Larry Crow is public information officer at the DMV.
There's no plan to redesign the plate. There's no push for that, nor has there been in any recent time. When and if in the future it does need to happen, it's going to involve a lot of people. It's going to involve the Division of Motor Vehicles, the Department of Safety, the legislature. But right now, everybody's very happy to see the old man on the plate of the car in front of them.
Behind all of this is our state emblem, a specific depiction of the old man that was adopted into law in 1945. Now, in 2017, with more than 70 years of history behind it, changing that symbol would require an act of legislation. Seems like a tough sell, so I called State Representative Gene Chandler to ask how likely he thinks it is.
Not that, don't take this personally, but I wouldn't waste much time thinking about it myself because I would so strongly oppose anything else that I wouldn't even give it any of my time.
In other words, it would take a strong public push to replace the old man as our official and unofficial state symbol. And 14 years since it collapsed, the memory of the famous profile is still holding strong.
It's just amazing. And to me, it's a hope for the future.
Bob Nunes is a volunteer at the Old Man Memorial site in Franconia Notch. He wanders the grounds, sharing folklore and chatting with tourists. He shows me a walking stick he carved himself. There's an inch-long profile of the old man right at the top. I asked Nunes whether he thinks it'll ever be time for the state to move on.
It's like we, our family before us, you don't throw away all the pictures after they die or mementos you got from them, you don't throw them away, you keep them in your heart. It's all part of what builds up the inside of you.
As I walked across the grounds and climbed up Cannon Mountain, I met a few tourists who had never heard of the old man, but most had.
I think it represents New Hampshire. I would say keep going.
Yeah. You don't look like you think this.
No, it's disappointing. I'm disappointed. I can't see it.
What do you guys think?
I would imagine forever. Why would they change it, right?
Even though it's gone, it's still, you know, a big thing that was around for a long time. Maybe give it 100 years.
I guess we'll just have to do a follow-up in 2117. I'm Taylor Quimby, and this is Word of Mouth, your questions answered, your state explored.
I'm Hannah McCarthy.
I'm Jimmy Gutierrez.
And Virginia Prescott is not here this week, which is why we're just having some fun in the studio, listening back to our favorite stories and hearing about how audiences liked or disliked them.
What's their beef?
Yeah.
Let's hear your beef.
This is another one that got people going.
Yeah.
The Old Man of the Mountain is an issue that people feel very strongly about here.
People have a lot of strong feelings in New Hampshire. I'm very surprised. I love it. This is what makes the show so great.
It keeps us going.
Yeah.
Anyway, we did a big poll when it came to the old man story because we wanted to know if, for some reason, if you had to, what would replace the old man on license plates or as the state symbol? So our producer, Logan Shannon, made a cool little poll and we talked about it. So welcome, Logan Shannon.
Hello.
So tell me, what did we ask and what did we put out there?
Well, we were pretty easygoing about this. We try not to ask too complicated of a question. And so the first question was, should New Hampshire stop using the old man in the mountain as our state emblem? And the options were no, 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 never. The other option was too soon, maybe in a few years, decades, or centuries. And the third option was, yes, it's time.
Okay. So what did people say?
So in general, it's interesting. It was split relatively evenly. In other words, nothing was a runaway.
Okay. Okay.
So yes, it's time got 37.3% of the votes.
Oh, wow.
No, 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 never also got 37.3% of the votes.
Huh.
And 25.3% said it's too soon, maybe in a few years, decades, or centuries.
Wow. It's almost like the too soons are the independent voters here. And right now, assuming that they're all going to eventually swing over to the yes, it's time side, there will be a public push. It's just not there yet.
Full disclosure, our sample size here is very small.
Truth.
We had 162 responses to this poll. The second question we asked was, if New Hampshire did stop using the old man of the mountain as our official emblem, what should it be replaced with? And we gave some options and also an other category.
Okay, so what did we give for options?
So the options we gave were the purple finch, a moose, Mount Washington, Indian Head, which is another rock formation that looks like a person, the Cog Railway, and then, of course, the other option.
When I spoke to people for this story, Mount Washington is one of the most frequently used examples of something that could replace the old man should the time come.
And that was the runaway for this.
Oh, was it?
Yeah. 60.4% of the people chose Mount Washington.
Okay. Wow.
23.9% chose other.
The write-in, you mean?
Yes.
Okay. So what were some of the options we had there?
So it was interesting. We had one person who was obviously trying to stuff the ballot box. and so we could say that perhaps you want to subtract 9 from 162, or 8. Let's say 8
okay.
from 162 responses, because we have 9 entries that say a drunk free stater screaming about taxes.
Somehow, I don't think the legislature is going to pick that one up.
That's a complicated thing to portray
yes.
in an emblem. Another person said a lobster drinking maple syrup under a covered bridge with a motorcycle driving up the Mount Washington Auto Road in the background during peak foliage.
Wow, that's everything.
One person said it was time. Yeah, we should definitely change it, and said, I'm not really sure what it should be, but because I'm from Portsmouth, it would be nice to have an emblem that represents the entire state and not just the North Country.
You know, I never really thought about the old man as being sort of regionalist.
Someone said the New England Patriots logo.
That might actually fly.
Really? I guess we should also say, full disclosure, I am not from the state of New Hampshire.
Yeah, but if there's something that people are as stubborn about when you compare the old man to, it could be sports fandom.
Yeah, I guess that's true. Very passionate.
Awesome. Well, thank you, Logan.
Oh, you're very welcome.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Taylor Quimby, in for Virginia Prescott. Today, we are looking back at some of the stories and interviews we've recently aired on the show, and we're hearing a little bit of your feedback about those stories and the new format that we're doing these days. Joining me in the studio here is Jimmy Gutierrez.
Yo.
And Hannah McCarthy.
Hiya.
And right now, we want to talk about something that comes up all the time in this line of business, and it has to do with regional pronunciations.
Ooh.
So, yeah, right.
Yep.
To set up this story, in our first show at the new time, part of that show, we spoke with Paul Puglio, who's chief and president of the Kawasuk Band of the Penacook Abenaki people. And he and Virginia Prescott were talking about all of the ways that New Hampshire geography is tied to the Algonquin languages that were present here long before colonization, names like Winnipesaukee, Squam, Ossipee, etc. And towards the end of that conversation, Chief Puglio started talking about New Hampshire's highways.
A lot of these highways should be given secondary plaque status and saying, well, this one's once the Ossipee Trail, or this was the Winnipesaukee Trail, or the Androscoggin Trail. I think, you know, we have one. We have the Kangamangas, you know, which we all identify with, and it's great that it's still called the Kangamangas Trail. But there are so many of these other trails which are now our major highways, should be given some recognition that these were the original Abenaki trails that were all over New Hampshire, and people really don't know that part of the history.
So locals listening to that clip may have caught something. Can either of you just say it for me?
Kangamangas?
Well, so should I
use it in a sentence?
How would you say it? How would you normally say it?
I would say Kangamangas.
Kangamangas. So with a G, Kanga.
Yeah, that's how my parents pronounced it.
Okay. Well, after that interview aired, we got an email from a listener named Valerie who said, quote, please, please, please have your New Hampshire reporters pronounce Kangamangas correctly. It is bad enough when out-of-staters don't know, but when local news people do the same thing, nobody will ever learn. Look at the way it's spelled. It is Kangamangas, not Kangamangas.
Valerie, you're coming for us.
The thing is people say words differently. There's lots of different regionalisms, and sometimes you have a word that is supposed to be a certain way until enough people don't say it that way.
Exactly.
I put another Twitter poll out since these are our new favorite things.
Okay.
50% of 40 respondents said they say Kangamangas, and I think it's solid 25% said they avoid the problem entirely by just calling it the Kank.
Yeah, I'd never heard it called the Kank until I moved here, but I have never heard anyone pronounce it Kanka. Wait, what is it again? Kangamangas?
Kangamangas.
It's Magus, like, yeah.
The thing I read online is if you can say August, you can say Kangamangas.
Kangamangas.
Thank you for calling the White Mountains. This is Pam. Can I help you?
Hi, Pam. My name's Taylor Quimby. I'm a public radio reporter. Can you just tell me your name and what you do?
Sure. My name is Pam, and I work for New Hampshire Attractions. It's a tourist information place in the White Mountains.
So I need you to settle a question for me, and it's very simple. Kangamangas, Kangamangas, Kangamangas.
Kangamangas.
Okay. Is that how is that the official way, or is that how everybody says it?
That's the official way. Everybody says it Kangamangas, but it is Kangamangas.
But philosophically speaking, if everybody says it Kangamangas, then
there's no N in it. So you have to.
Okay. Okay, so I think it's time to move on. We are now going to hear another story from our Only New Hampshire series. This one is one of yours, Hannah. And it starts out sort of like a ghost story.
Yeah, that's what I'm drawn to.
This is Sammer.
So, Sammer noticed that in the year 2000 U.S. Census, there were three people living in Livermore, New Hampshire. But in the year 2010, they were gone. So he wanted to know, what happened to them?
The concept of ghost towns kind of interested me anyway.
That's the tricky thing about this census question, Sammer. Livermore is a ghost town. As in, no longer alive. The town was abandoned about 60 years ago. Population zero. Oh, and it happens to be smack dab in the middle of the White Mountain National Forest. You go up a long dirt road, narrow in places where the river has washed it out, and there are ruins. Bricks crumbling into overgrown foundations. The odd bed frame or bank vault slowly becoming one with the forest.
Oh, cool, there's an old Pepsi can. Totally gonna get tetanus.
So, how did three people end up on the census for a ghost town on public land? Well, I kind of figured it had to be a hoax.
That's not really how it works in terms of, the census has a list of addresses that, you know, that they send forms to.
This is Ken Gallagher from the New Hampshire Office of Energy and Planning. It turns out you can't play a practical joke on the U.S. Census. They have a list.
Having the list of addresses first would prevent somebody living in Concord, for instance, saying, oh, I live in Livermore, that sort of thing. That just doesn't happen.
According to Ken, if the census says someone lives in Livermore, then there's got to be a place for someone to live in Livermore. The only problem is I couldn't find that place. Not on maps or search engines or in old phone books. Besides, we were talking about a national forest. Who lives in a national forest?
When you see the maps of the White Mountain National Forest, you might see one, you know, big green blob, right? This is where the boundaries are. However, that's just the maximum boundary of the forest. Within the national forest, it's much more of a patchwork.
And this is how I learned about inholdings. Private land within public land. So that green blob, the boundary of the forest, it only tells you where the U.S. Forest Service can own land. but they don't own everything in there.
I would expect probably at least 10% of the land within the what's called the proclamation boundary may well be privately owned.
So it isn't that weird for someone to live in a national forest. But it is still pretty weird for someone to live in a town where, you know, nobody lives.
Essentially, we believe nobody lives there. But you might want to check with, like, Grafton County, the Grafton County office.
Good morning, Deeds Office.
So I took Ken's advice, and I called Beth Wyman at the Grafton County Deeds Office. I have a question about what may or may not be an inholding in the boundaries of Livermore.
Yeah, I remember we have seen a deed before come through here in Livermore, but you don't know the name of the owner or anything like that.
Okay, listeners, at this point, I did happen to have a name. It was a name that popped up over and over again while I was digging around online. Two people that just might be the key to solving this mystery. Bob and Betty Shackford of Conway, New Hampshire.
Okay, yeah, I do see things listed for them in Livermore. And the latest thing I have was in 2005.
There are only 12 acres of private land left in Livermore. The rest is national forest. And all 12 are deeded, to this day, to the Shackfords. But that's where the trail went cold, because Bob passed away in 1992, and Betty, it turns out, died just this spring. But how did they end up owning the land in the first place? And why was Livermore abandoned? To find out, I spoke with Peter Crane, a White Mountain historian who did his doctoral dissertation on Livermore in the early 1990s. Livermore might be a collection of crumbling ruins now, but it had a good 50-year run. The town sprang up in the 1870s when two brothers, the Saunders, decided to launch a logging operation in the White Mountains. They built a town, a mill, and a railroad. Workers moved in and brought their families, and the brothers built a company store and then a school. And for a while, that town thrived, turning timber into lumber, lumber into cash. People were married, babies were born. By 1900, the population hit around 200. But then, things started to go downhill. The Saunders brothers died and left the whole operation to an attorney who might not have known how to run a lumber company. Population in 1920, 98. And then a fire destroyed the mill, and their one train on the Sawyer River Railroad fell into the river. And then there was a huge flood in 1927. That took out the railroad itself. Population in 1930, 23. And then, of course, there are the trees, the whole reason the town was built to begin with. In just a few decades, the loggers of Livermore had cut most of the good stuff. Population in 1940, 4 souls. By 1950, the town was empty. A year after that, it was disincorporated. Population in 1960, 0. In 1970, 1980, 1990, 0. In 2000, 3.
We have people all the time come up during the summer, and they're always curious of how we acquired Livermore, and I love telling the story on.
I met the Shackfords, 3 generations of them, in Bob and Betty's home in Conway, after spending weeks tracking down a phone number. And I spoke with Matt, Mark, and Gary. That's Bob and Betty's grandson and 2 of their 3 sons. It turns out they tell their story all the time, because it's a pretty good one. When Bob first bought the place, there was an original Livermore house on the property, a 26-room mansion owned by those loggers back in the day. But transient hippies were in the habit of spending the night
fornicating in the bedrooms.
Yes, there was a lot of those.
Well, they started tearing down the inside. Fire, you know, yeah. They'd rip it up all apart. And,
here and there.
You know, they wouldn't go out and chop wood. They'd just take down a banister. Nice and dry wood, you know.
Right.
Eventually, Bob had to raise the mansion, but he built the camp in its place, a little red cabin not far from the ruins of Old Livermore. It was a cabin that he would share with his children and eventually his grandson, Matt, the man who holds the key to the Livermore Three.
That was me. I walked up to the gentleman. He was asking if we lived there. I said I'd like to, and kind of as a joke, I threw it out that we lived there, and at least for the summer, and he said that. So, hopeful thinking, I think. I was wishing I could live up there for a year.
So that's the story. A census taker ran into Matt and his parents up at the old camp, and wishful thinking turned into official census data. None of the Shackfords are actually residents of Livermore, but their inheritance means a lot to them. All of them agree there's something still very much alive about Livermore.
And you still feel it.
You really can.
You can feel the spirit of Livermore and the town.
I gave Sammer a call to let him know that I got to the bottom of his census question.
Wow. That's pretty interesting. So it's kind of somewhat a clerical error, but it's an interesting journey to that clerical error. I thought for a second when you were talking about parcels of land, there's going to be some kind of origin for like a Stephen King novel or something. But the actual answer was also incredibly interesting too.
My pleasure, Sammer. And who knows? If Matt Shackford gets his way, Livermore might find its way back onto the U.S. Census in a slightly more legitimate way.
I'd like to build a few more houses and get 12 people living up there and be the first ones to vote and free up the town. And
yeah, maybe we'll do that.
Yeah.
Hannah McCarthy there reporting on Livermore for our Only in New Hampshire series. I'm Taylor Quimby, and this is Word of Mouth, Your Questions Answered, Your State Explored. Hannah, that story is awesome.
Thanks. I was surprised by how satisfying it was to report on.
Because of the like sort of investigative nature?
Not just that. I've attempted to report plenty of stories that just lead nowhere, and I was expecting exactly that. Or just to get a, you know, sort of murky history about Livermore, and then to find the family that owns it, which took me forever. But it was just, and then they were willing to speak with me.
Yeah.
Which was wonderful.
Have you ever considered another career as a private eye?
Oh, ooh. Yeah. I certainly have. I was basically Harriet the Spy as a child, so.
she was a boss.
Yeah.
So would you recommend that people take a visit? I mean, is it touristy?
No, I don't think so, at least. I've been up there twice now, and the really important thing to know is that the Shackfords really do still have a house there, and they still go and visit. And that is their private property, and you can't screw around on the house, you know?
Yeah.
I just don't want anyone going up there and trying to, like, break it. I mean, they used to have hikers and further back hippies who would go up there and assume that the house was an AT hut or something, and then would break in even though it was closed and leave notes like there wasn't enough toilet paper.
Really?
Not great. But I would recommend a visit. That is where I got Lyme disease.
I was going to say something. I didn't want to bring it up, though.
Yeah. So if you go, please tuck your pants into your socks and wear a hat and go in the middle of the winter or something. I don't know. It's actually better to go when there are fewer leaves on the trees and when you're less likely to be bitten by a tick.
Mm.
But it's beautiful.
Yeah. Gorgeous, but full of deer ticks. So.
That's right.
Did you hear much from folks who listened to the story?
Well, I didn't get a ton of response.
Well, it's a tale, you know. You sit by the fire and you listen.
I did get a very interesting single response from somebody. Weeks after it aired, I got an email from this guy named Sam Ward.
Mm-hmm.
Sam wrote me to say that he really loved the story. He really loves New Hampshire. He's not even a resident of New Hampshire. But what connected him especially to the story was that his grandmother was born in Livermore, and he gave me the exact date, July 28th, 1906. Oh. And she used to talk about what it was like to live in the town as a very young girl, and she would tell him that it's since been abandoned, and he says he never understood why it was abandoned, what that even really meant, until he listened to the Livermore story.
Wow.
So,
there we go.
Man, it's so crazy to think. I mean, over the course of Livermore's history, there was probably only a few hundred people that were born and grew up in that space. I mean, you said at the most there was a couple hundred people living there?
Yes, exactly.
Yeah, so generationally, you know, there's probably...
Like 1,000 people?
Less than, is my guess.
Yeah, yeah.
In which case, I mean, that's a pretty rare little find there that he caught onto the story.
And just the fact that he is in Toronto listening to NHPR, and he's really into the Only in New Hampshire series because he loves New Hampshire.
That's great.
So, yes.
Well, thank you, and I think it's time to move on to our next story. But first, we've got to take a break. This is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio. Stay tuned. This is Word of Mouth, your questions answered, your state explored. I'm Taylor Quimby, in for Virginia Prescott. And today we're looking back at some of our favorite Only in New Hampshire questions. That's our series where we take your questions submitted through a handy online submission form at nhpr.org, and we send our producers out to chase down the answers. I'm here with Hannah McCarthy. Hello, Hannah.
Hey there.
Also, Jimmy Gutierrez.
Yellow.
And Jimmy, you recently took me out on a little fun trip to the seacoast. Why don't you set this next story up? What was the question, and what appealed to you about it?
Yeah, so this question came from listener Carl Daly from Portsmouth, who had just moved into the area, I believe it was a little over a year before, with his wife. Mm-hmm. He took advantage of our Only in New Hampshire series and asked us, why does Portsmouth shut down at 9 p.m.?
9 p.m.?
9 p.m., right. 9 p.m. sounds over the top sarcastic, but at the same time, 9 p.m. is not far off if it's not Friday or Saturday.
Yeah. So we booked it in Airbnb. We went out there and we met up with Carl with the express notion that we would stay up as late as possible, partially to push that 9 p.m. I think 9 p.m. I was suspicious of, but partially just to see, you know, if we could have a good time at Portsmouth.
Right.
Wait, can I ask? So you guys booked an Airbnb assuming that you would be able to stay up past 9. Is that the idea?
That was the idea.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Well, also, we were planning on drinking a little bit.
Yeah.
No driving.
Very responsible.
Hey. Hi. Nice to meet you.
Nice to meet you.
Jimmy.
Taylor.
Nice to meet you.
You too.
Sarah.
It was 7:30 and pouring rain outside when we met with Carl and his wife, Sarah Moranti, at their favorite spot in Portsmouth, the Rusty Hammer.
This is one of the few remaining, like, old places that hasn't been turned into a Starbucks analog.
So Carl grew up in a college town, and then he went to college in another college town.
So he's all about a proper late-night scene. And that's why when he and Sarah moved here a year ago, it was a bit of a culture shock.
Well, I was working second shift when we moved here, so I would get off work at, like, 12. Can't even eat food if we're hungry. Can't even grocery shop. Can't do anything. And, you know, since we're new to the area, we want to, like, meet people, like, go out for drinks, and bars would be closed by the time we got down here.
And this is why we came out here, to stay out all night and get a sense of Portsmouth's nightlife, and maybe have some fun.
But, like, a public radio amount of appropriate fun.
Wait, is it beer before liquor and you've never been sicker?
Just don't drink too much, I think.
We started the night off with a little bar talk.
Talking about sports, craft beer, and old school cartoons.
Speedy Gonzales, you can't even Speedy play Gonzales. That on TV anymore.
It's your call.
And then Sarah says that Portsmouth is a lot of folks' dream retirement spot. But what about young people and young families?
They have a different set of wants and needs when it comes to community.
Like a 24-hour diner, maybe? Like a place for food?
Bar with a, you know, good jukebox and, you know, pool table, something like that.
There is a place where there is music almost every night.
Like live music?
Yeah.
Taylor had a suggestion for our next stop in the night, a two-story bar with an Irish sort of vibe called the Press Room.
We have not been in there, but we've been told to go.
I think there's live music.
Okay, so what time was it now?
It was 10 o'clock when we went to go check out the Press Room.
At least we made it past 9, right?
Right, right, and it was still pouring out.
Hey, this is the sign for the Press Room. I don't know how to get in there.
When we got there, the windows were completely blacked out and the spot was empty.
Live music, seven nights.
Seriously, are they closed on a Friday night? I mean, they clearly are, but...
Did they shut down?
Turns out they did shut down a little over a month before.
I'm so disappointed about the fact that they're closed.
But it didn't take us too long to find something else.
So on the same block, we stumbled into this very large, bald dude sitting on a bar stool outside of a very loud and very interesting-looking bar. Jimmy was worried the guy wouldn't let him in because of his microphone.
Hey. Can we bring this in?
I don't know what is it.
It's just a little
anal probe.
No.
Turns out this was another one of Sarah and Carl's favorite spots, D Street Tavern.
I like it because where I'm standing right now, the floor is sticky, which is always a good sign of a legitimate bar.
It's true.
Everything in here is probably sticky.
So at this point, I picked up a round of highly questionable Jello shots for everybody. This was Carl and Sarah's idea, by the way. And by that time, it was...
So it's 10:30 on the nose. Carl and Sarah just took off. We're over at the D Street Tavern, karaoke central of the world.
Can I just say that we didn't specifically say that we wanted to stay out with them all night, but, I mean,
it's 10:30? Come on, team, that's minor leagues.
There was an impromptu dance floor, pool. Jimmy and I were trying to put our finger on what we were digging about this place.
It was a townie bar.
Which you totally loved.
I did, and I loved the people we met there.
The lady that's at the bar right now, that is my Aunt Marge. Her husband owns this bar.
Really?
Yes, absolutely. So I know...
You're royalty.
Yeah, absolutely.
This is Patty.
Patty.
She was born and raised in Portsmouth. We spotted her at the bar with her friend and, of course, a pint in her hand.
And she was wearing the cleanest Larry Bird jersey I've ever seen.
Can I tell you, this is an original.
Is that really?
Yeah, Larry Bird gave this to my father years ago. Like,
you have so much street cred right now.
I asked Patty to drop some Portsmouth knowledge on us. She says if we want to see late night fights, Gilly is the spot. I tell her we had a little pub action and are enjoying the live music. But now it was time for something else.
So if I want to dance after this, where do I go?
The Gaslight all day, yeah.
I remember that it was actually pretty tough convincing you to leave.
Oh, get out of here. If I remember right, it was you that was getting pretty close to stretching your karaoke muscles.
That guy did not know the rhythm of Teenage Dirtbag.
Fair enough. Anyway, it was time for a different venue. Speaking of time, clock check?
When we rolled up to the club, it was 11:30. We had an hour and a half until bar close. At this point, the rain had cleared, and there were about a dozen people dressed up in their Tinder best waiting in line. And that wasn't all.
Hold on, is that a velvet rope? Okay, so we're in Portsmouth right now. We're at the Gaslight, and we literally have a velvet rope situation.
Jimmy, you sound a little skeptical there.
Listen, there was a velvet rope. I'm just saying, this seemed a little fancy for New Hampshire.
New Hampshire can have velvet rope. Anyway, that's when security spotted you with your recording gear.
Yeah, and since we didn't plan ahead, we were probably a bizarre sight to see. Anyways, after a little schmoozing, we were skipping the line like a couple of big shots.
Can I grab him too?
Grab him too. Yeah. Go ahead.
TQ!
3 floors later, there we were.
My name's Brandon. I'm the head of security. So if you need anything, Jimmy, let me know.
Okay.
The dance floor was kind of smaller than I thought, and then the bar area was much bigger than I would have thought. And there was a lot of VIP sections.
And apparently on Friday nights they get up to 150 people, even more on Saturdays. But you knew it was a real spot because they even had their own customized pens.
There was also some really interesting people there.
How about I get you an interview with a retired New England Patriot?
That'd be solid.
This is definitely a little radio magic in action.
For starters, my name is Patrick Pass. I'm in Portsmouth, New Hampshire. At the famous Gaslight, where everyone comes to party, have a good time.
3-time Super Bowl champ and retired New England Patriot, Patrick Pass, was hanging out in the VIP, sectioned off by more of those fancy velvet ropes.
So this is the part of the night where I got the impression, Jimmy, you were like, okay, Portsmouth is starting to feel pretty legit.
There was a random football player in the VIP. Of course it was. I was very surprised.
Is it weird that he was this far north in the offseason?
No, it's very unusual because you don't see guys like myself that comes this far north, because a lot of guys when they're done football, they either go back to the place where they was born or play college football.
Patrick was running his fifth annual Skills and Drills camp across the state. When we asked him how he'd improve Portsmouth nightlife, he said there needed to be more spots for the grown and sexy, like some nice cocktail lounges.
So once you stopped talking about his Super Bowl ring...
It was impressive.
It was. It was very nice. I was just wandering around for like 20 minutes. By that time, it was quarter past midnight, so 45 minutes to bar close.
Back to the streets.
What are you guys doing?
Exactly. This is Lynette, and we met her with her friend Melinda. The two of them have spent over a decade in Portsmouth's service industry. So I asked, if they could, what would they change about this place?
I wish places stayed open there, yeah. This is ridiculous. We're trying to find places, and we're like, nothing open. It's the most frustrating thing, and then I'm like, okay, let me go read my book or watch Netflix.
You know, like in like New York and Boston, they are open until like 5 a.m. Mm-hmm. So that's what most people are used to, and if they come and visit anybody down here, it's like, oh, like let's go out at 11. It's like, well, everybody's either hammered at that point, or you literally have an hour and a half, and then you're done.
They say Portsmouth needs more places to dance, to push back bar close, and to add more late-night dining options.
It's 12:20?
Yeah.
So, like, you have 40 minutes to, like, get it in.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
We gotta get it
in. Okay.
How'd you feel about me giving out your Facebook information?
Well, you know, I mean, I barely use it, so.
Do you have Facebook?
I do.
Is it weird? Can I add you?
Yeah. My name's Taylor Quimby.
It was funny when I realized they friended me later. Instantly.
Okay, add me. Okay.
Bye, team. Have fun. Enjoy your 40 minutes.
At this point, we still had to confirm that Portsmouth didn't completely shut down at bar close, and that meant finding an after bar.
Well, hold on. When you say an after bar,
yeah,
what do you mean? I'm still confused about what that means.
Okay, an after bar is essentially an after-hours place, hopefully a bar, possibly a house of some sort or a residence, that invites folks in to enjoy themselves after hours.
Okay, so Friendly Toast is down there, and that's definitely a restaurant that we can eat food in.
Okay.
I don't know about these after bars, because that sounds like an establishment that doesn't exist in New Hampshire.
So we decided to grab some eats at the Friendly Toast, which was one of a few places still serving.
All the way till 2 a.m.
Right. Here we go. We're entering the Friendly Toast.
Hey, our people are still here.
And the toast was jam-packed. Even more impressive, it picked up the longer we were in there.
By the time we got our food, it was 1:30. Taylor went with a breakfast burrito, and for myself...
You got pancakes?
I got pancakes. Yeah, look at... Oh my gosh, look at those pancakes. They're beautiful.
They're gigantic.
Thank you so much.
So, Jimmy, what did we learn about Portsmouth?
I'm going to be surprisingly cool on this, but there are limited options with an early bar close and just a few late night dining options.
Dude, come on. You had such a good time.
But it was a great night. I had a blast. I'm just saying, if you work second shift in this state, you probably spend a lot of late nights with Netflix.
Yeah.
TQ, what did you learn?
I think it's all relative. Most nights I'm home with Netflix anyway, so by comparison, I thought our night out in Portsmouth was pretty crazy.
Look at this pancake, man. I would marry this pancake.
Ooh. Black beans.
And that after bar never happened.
It's because after bars aren't a thing.
I would marry this pancake, it says. Marry a pancake.
I'm Taylor Quimby, and this is Word of Mouth. Your questions answered, your state explored. Jimmy, that was such a fun story. We actually heard some really nice feedback from folks who shared Carl's perspective. It was nice to get an out-of-towner's perspective.
Yeah, and I think we got the same vibe when we were talking to people on the street, that this doesn't get talked about enough. And New Hampshire and Portsmouth have a bar close at 1 a.m.,
yeah,
which is relatively early. I think it's one of the earliest in the country. My guess was Utah. I think that's what we were talking
really?
About.
Really? Hold on, let me look this up.
And Utah.
Oh, that's by law it closes at 1?
Right.
And people make fun of Boston.
Hold on, we're going to Google this. Earliest bar closes. Oh my God. You know, I really thought 1 a.m. was standard, but you're right.
No, it's not.
It's not standard.
It's like 2 a.m.
This is the only place I've ever been where the bar closes 1 a.m.
All right, Nebraska, also 1 a.m. Maine, also 1 a.m. So most seem to be 2 or later. Huh. Gosh, wow. I feel crazy. having grown up in New Hampshire and spent most of my post 21 life here, I don't know why you just assume that this is, you know, what you grow up with is normal.
And think about folks, it's not normal. Think about folks that come in that are acclimated to, you know, maybe starting their night at 10 or 11, you know?
And that sounds awful, though. I mean,
well, exactly. I mean, you're sleepy. Yeah. Sleepy Quimby. That's what we call you.
Well, thanks, guys. It was a lot of fun having you in the studio and listening back to these stories. Jimmy, I really appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks, TQ.
That's Jimmy Gutierrez. And also, Hannah, thank you so much.
Of course. It was fun.
Producer Hannah McCarthy. Remember, if you have a question that you want to ask us here for the Only in New Hampshire series, you can do it very easily at nhpr.org. Music in this episode from Ari De Niro, Poddington Bear, and Tyler Gibbons. I'm Taylor Quimby, in for Virginia Prescott, who will be back next week for more of your questions answered, your state explored, here on Word of Mouth.